And then the doctor comes in, Dr. Joseph Venglos.
Yeah.
What was your first take at him?
Strange.
Was he a strange guy?
Clever guy. Unbelievable. Well, doctor, yeah, unbelievably. But when you hear of a doctor coming in to be a manager of a football club, it's like, well, okay, how does that work? And the really nice guy, you know, way out there in terms of his methods. You know, he had us running around the training pitch, holding our breath in terms of, you know, this will help with your breathing and your respiratory and all this. And we were like, whoa, we were running around holding our breath and we had to try and hold it for as long as we could. And you were running around going, and it was just a bit weird.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was just a bit strange.
Would you like to play? Would you like used to play?
Yeah, but we'd gone from having a real connection with Vim and embracing the way he was and his style and really getting it to Dr. Joe, who we'd call him by. And it just didn't happen. It just didn't happen.
Did he allow the Tuesdays or was that finished?
No, not really.
No.
Maybe that's what one of the reasons why. You know, he didn't take too fondly of them.
Right, you know, okay.
Would have even asked him to come if he wanted to, but no, it didn't happen. Didn't happen.
There was few highlights that year for Celtic, but you scored an absolute ripper at Ibrox.
Yeah, it's probably.
Where did that come from?
I don't know. Probably me when I was a younger striker. You know, pull one out the locker. It was. Did they curl it into the top corner?
Was it not a strike?
Was it a strike?
Had it. A bit of both. I had a bit of everything.
Striking a bit of curls.
What? Yeah, from the edge of the box in the corner.
Edge of box.
I thought it was sophisticated and.
Plymouth Argyle. A bit of Plymouth Argyle, huh?
Yeah, there was a little bit on it. That was my favourite goal.
Cool. At Celtic, was it?
Yeah.
Or your career, no?
One of both, actually. Uh-huh. I, you know, to score at Ibrox and I think I ran away, actually, like that, didn't I? At that time. I think it was just the same, pleasing. I think we drew it 2-2. Yeah, that was probably my favourite goal at Celtic. Yeah, not bad.
And then 1999, you get your scare.
Yeah. Obviously, comes out the blue. We'd just been beaten by Rangers, I think, in the Scottish Cup. I think Rod Wallace scored late on. And I was one of the chosen ones for the drug test at the end. Little, obviously, do I know that it was going to lead to what happened after it. People now want to look back and go, wow, how unlucky were you? But it was the complete opposite. It was how lucky was I? You know, because if I wouldn't have been picked to have a drug test or a urine test, then God knows what would have happened. I got a phone call about four or five weeks later off the dock at Celtic, Jack Mulhern. He was a great guy. And I was on the golf course with my friend, Mark Seagraves, who I played with at Bolton. And we were just, I think we were only maybe on the eighth hole. So Jack rings me, Alan, how are you? I said, yeah, I'm good, thanks. He said, can you speak? I said, well, I'm on the golf course, but yeah. You know, when he went, well, he said, well, listen, your drug test has come back positive. I've started laughing, I've gone, impossible. You know, I don't take anything. You know me, Jack, you know, that's not me. And he went, I know that. He said, but well, what it's come back positive, as in what you're producing is normally only found in pregnant women. But when it's found in the men, it's linked to cancer. So he said, how are you feeling? I said, well, before you said that, I was feeling great. I said, so he went, no, in general, he said, you don't feel fatigued, anything like that. I said, no, I said, I feel great, normal. So he went, okay, we need you to come up to do some tests. So anyway, so that was, just say for instance, that was the Wednesday. Celtic sent a car down for me on the Friday morning. Spoke to me family, told them, obviously, as you can imagine, it's everyone's, the word cancer is like devastation. So went up with my wife, went for an ultrasound, came back, and you could see it was obvious. you know, there was an area of light grey, which is good, and there was an area of black dark colour, which is not good. So we said, that's the problem. So then we said okay, so we've seen a specialist, and he said, right, we need to do an operation. He said, basically, it's just like a hernia operation. He says, we'll remove the testicle, do the biopsy, and then we'll see what's what with it. So I said, okay, great. I said, when do you want to do it? And I went, well, do you want to go home and think about it and we'll come up with a date? I said, no. Just tell me when you want me here. He went, well, we could do Monday if you want. So I said, great, no problem. And he was like, he was a bit taken aback from it. So then had the operation, had the biopsy. It was found to be benign, so which it was just dormant sitting there, and which I was lucky. And then they said, like, we're happy, we're not going to give you any chemotherapy, we're happy with everything, not going to give you no chemotherapy. I said, okay. So then 6 weeks later, back playing, no problems. Then I was going for a scan every 3 months then, just as a precaution and a follow. And then after about, I think it was about just over a year, maybe 12, 14 months, went for the scan again. And then the radiologist read it, and then I got a phone call later on at night saying, Alan, listen, there's something showed up on the scan. I said, okay, well, what? He said, well, we need to do some more checks and stuff like that, but I don't want to alarm you just yet, but we found something. I said, okay. So then next minute, went into the hospital, and then I had about 3 or 4 specialists at the table and said, right, we've spoken to all the top specialists about it. It says, and we think there's a tumour at the base of your spine. It's probably like the size of a pea at the moment. We want to go in and we want to give you chemotherapy and try and attack it there. And then what we'll do, we'll give you the courses. We intend on giving you 4 courses to start off, but we'll monitor after each one. And if it'll do 3 things, it'll either reduce it in size, it will slow the growth, or it will completely obliterate it. So I've said, okay. So anyway, I had the chemotherapy. Doctor said, okay, you ready? I said, yeah, fire away. Whenever you want me in, I'm in. So that was, my first one was over 3 days, which was quite intense, you know, but I didn't feel the effects of it. And I'm thinking, okay, no, it wasn't too bad. But I know it can be horrendous for some people. And probably the fact that I was a sports person probably helped me, you know, deal with it probably better, because I was fitter and stuff like that. And then suddenly there was an Old Firm game on after me first one. And I was watching the game with Tommy Johnson in Newton Mearns, and it was the second half. And then suddenly I felt like crap. And I felt like I was getting hot flushes. I was freezing. I said, Tommy, you need to take me home. I said, I feel awful. So the next minute, got home. My parents up at the time, in the room. Amanda's gone, right, I'm going to ring the hospital. So I rang the hospital and said, like, get him in straight away. So then I've gone in and I've said, listen, all you've done, I said, you've probably picked up the smallest of bug. And because your immune system's down, it's like a full-blown flu. So in, and I was out after a few days. And then second course of chemotherapy, had the scan. And then when I had the scan, he said, listen, we want to operate. It's reducing in size. So then they cut me open, you know, scar probably about that size down the front, take everything out to get to the tumour. I was operating theatre 8-9 hours, out, intensive care, job done, basically. And then I was back playing within 3 months. So it was an ordeal, but I was lucky. Uh-huh. I was lucky, you know.
Scary thought, huh?
It is, but, you know, there's, when you look at some people who don't have the opportunity to sit here and talk about it, that's scary.
Uh-huh.
You know, I was lucky. I was very fortunate that I was at a brilliant football club, that I was a professional footballer, and we were getting monitored all the time. So if anyone says to me, you're unlucky, then, you know, I would beg to, I'd beg to differ.
Uh-huh. As you say, you managed to recover and still played a significant part in that, easy to say, in that season. How do you reflect on the John Barnes era?
It wasn't great.
No.
It wasn't great.
Why?
I think probably, you know, John's come in and I speak to Kenny, and Kenny's, he had a remit and he had a budget and he tried something different and it didn't work. And I think Kenny would be first to hold his hand up and say, you know, it didn't work. I think John had probably not got over the fact from being a player to a manager that quick. And we felt as if there was just he didn't trust us. You know, there was an incident early on in pre-season where we went to a hotel, and the hotel was fine. It was very basic. Pre-season times, you find that. It was more about the training and the elements. And the food at the hotel was really poor, you know, and we wanted to try and get some decent food into us to try and refuel so that we could go on the following day and train well. So there was a restaurant in the town, which was only 2 or 3 minutes away in a taxi. So we went to dinner. We never ate. There was about 6 or 7 of us. And we waited till everybody was allowed to leave. And then we left and we went into town and we bought our own food, our own pasta. And the next minute, John comes diving in with Eric Black, and we'd at the table and we were just about to eat. And I had a Coke. I think there was Craig Bailey, Tommy Johnson, Jackie, Darren Jackson. Tommy had a lemonade. And I can assure you, on my kids' lives, we weren't drinking. You know, and then John's come in and he just leaned over Tommy and grabbed Tommy's drink and gone, "Can I have a bit, Tommy?" And he'd already tasted it before they even said it, because he thought we were drinking. Mm-hmm. And from that day onwards, it just seemed to go downwards, you know. And we thought, John, for me, he'd give the forward players and everything, he'd give them a license to basically do what they want. And we'd come from being a team. And then suddenly you've got like the likes of your Al Berkoviches and stuff like that, being told to, well, you can attack, express yourself in the final third, do what you want. And then where you are, I've got the ball, just jog back into position. And we're like, as defenders and midfield players of the team, jog back into position. You know, get your
sprint back,
butt back in there as quick as you can. And it just felt as if it was like, it was them and us. And it created something which wasn't great.
See, we're managers, you are a manager.
Yeah.
Is personality everything, do you think?
I think it's a big part. Mm-hmm. I think my management's even bigger. I think you'd have to be able to manage the players in the right way. I think you have to understand them. I think you sometimes have to try and get in. You become like psychologists, because you can't treat everybody the same. You have to give some a little bit more rope. You have to tighten the rope on a few players. You know, you'll have the ones who are not a minute's problem, who you can not worry about whatsoever. So I think man management is one of the biggest things in terms of managing, mm-hmm. and recruitment. I think for me, they're the biggest two.
John Barnes leaves and Celtic appoint Martin O'Neill.
Yeah.
What were your thoughts on?
Well, I think we all knew Martin's record, or Martin, what he'd done in England. You know, he comes in and it was chalk and cheese. Uh-huh. You know, it really was. It was, Martin was unbelievable. You know, just in terms of his demeanour, he was very much his own person. Martin would walk past us right now, not say a word, and blank you. And he'd walk past you 5 minutes later and go, "Sorry about that before, I was thinking about something." Uh-huh. That was him. He was an enigma. He was, you know, he had his own way, but it worked. And the players loved him. They loved his backroom staff, Steve Walford, John Robertson, brilliant. They all had their own different personalities, which all seemed to work. They all seemed to blend in. Martin was very much the thinker. Great way about him. He'd walk past you and he'd say to you, give you a new contract, right? Come and see me. And then not say nothing for another 2 months, and you're thinking, what have I done? What have I done wrong? And then following week, you go, that contract's on my table. It's been sitting there for 6 weeks. Just come and see me when you're ready. And that was the way he was, you know. And I wouldn't, there's not many players that would have a bad word to say about Martin.
You won the treble that year, your last year at Celtic.
Yeah.
Good way to finish off your career at Celtic.
It was a good way. Uh-huh. I would have loved to have played more of a part in it. But I think I won more that season than the treble, you know, because of what I'd been through.
True.
You know, it's as if I'd won the quadruple, you know, which was a great way to end a roller coaster season.
Big part of your life up there, isn't it, Celtic?
A huge part. Uh-huh. You know, people always say, and people always look back and say, do you think it had an impact on me playing for England? And I was getting linked at the time with me making a cap. And honestly, do I? Yeah, I do. Do I regret it? Not for 1 minute. You know, because if I would have got an England cap or two or three or whatever, then yes, it's a fantastic achievement. But I think the bigger achievement was saying that I played for a club like Celtic.
Brilliant. And then your boyhood club, Everton, coming for you. Dream come true?
Yeah, but difficult, because obviously the way the club had looked after me, I'd obviously come towards the end of the season. Martin had said to me, listen, there's a new contact there for you. He'd offered me a 2-year deal, even with me coming through everything like that, which I thought was unbelievable, the football club. But Everton was the big spanner in the works. And I said to Martin, I said, listen, I'm really struggling to choose between the two. And he said, listen, I know how much Everton means to you. I said, go down and speak to them. He said, and if it doesn't work out, the contract's still there for you, which is Martin.
That's brilliant, eh?
It's Martin in a nutshell.
Mm-hmm.
He just had a way about him, a knack about him. And I go down and I speak to Walter Smith, and the layer of playing for me boyhood team was just too much to turn down in the end. You know, and it was a dream that I'd wanted to do, you know, for an awful long time. And I thought I'd missed it, if I'm being honest. I thought that it had gone, you know, but no. And then I ended up spending six, seven years there.
How was Walter Smith?
He was great, you know.
Uh-huh.
He was as a person, great man, a great man. You know, he was a proper manager, great with the players, ruthless when he needs to be. One that you don't get into an argument with.
Did you ever?
No. Yeah. I wasn't that daft. I'd seen him, you know, blow the top a few times. Mm-hmm. And when Walter blows, it's got to be something serious for him to blow. Normally, a very, very calm and collected person. I think with Walter, when he was there, you know, you probably didn't see Walter as a manager and what he could do, I think. Is that because Walter had to, you know, probably feel the brunt of where Everton were at that time from a financial point of view. You know, it was as if Walter was always trying to put fires out, you know, in terms of his transfers, his budget, wheeling and dealing. You know, Walter wanted to obviously bring in a certain type of player that he'd identified to move the club forward, but always felt, I think sometimes, as if no matter what he did, he'd come up against a brick wall. And I think he had a good relationship with the board there, but I think it was probably coming from Rangers and being a dominant and powerful enterprise to go into Everton and probably getting told no and no and no. It was a difficult period for him. It would have been a difficult period for any manager coming in to Everton at that time.
Was Gasco in there with him?
Gazza was there.
How was he? Madman.
Brilliant.
Funny.
Just a brilliant bloke. I actually, for Gazza, you know, we all know Gazza's got a heart of gold, and he's the one that everybody loves. He's like the nation's favourite footballer, Gazza, as I look at him, you know. But it was a shame to see him the way he was, you know, type of thing. I'll always say I had the privilege of playing with Gazza, but I didn't have the privilege of playing with him when he was in his prime.
Mm. You know, had he gone a bit then?
He was starting to, you know, to to come towards the end of his career. Still see moments of magic, but not all magic. Because for me, Gazza was magic. Mm. You know, one of the best players I've seen and probably played against. But a heart of gold.
Ever on the receiving end of a prank in it?
Yeah. We've had, you know, Gazza was, in terms of his personality, he was unbelievable.
What sort of stuff did he do?
There was one time where we'd, he loved his fishing, Gazza. So he used to go away with Jimmy, and he used to be a kit man at Everton called Flannel. And he used to always go fishing, keep him occupied, basically. Yeah, you know, if you occupy him, he's out of trouble. So he'd go fishing, and he'd come back one day with these big salmons. So he'd give one to the chef upstairs, and he kept one himself. The next minute, he gets the kit man's keys to his car, and he puts half of it in the bonnet, under the bonnet, and half of it under the seat at the back. So he thinks, if he smells the bonnet one, he'll think he's got it, but he's still got the other one. So he's done that one day, and this has gone on for like 4 or 5 days now, and the kit man's coming and going, something stinks in my car, you know, I don't know what it is. And we're all like, oh, that, and we all know what's going on. And next minute, he's gone, come in one day and gone, who the F and L's put that vision? Gazza, where is he? So he's gone, oh, Jimmy, sorry, mate, sorry. Anyway, a couple of weeks have gone by, and this, obviously, fish rotten, stinking. And Gazza, in the end, he had to say, Jimmy, listen, there's one in the back seat of the door. Gazza had actually paid for him to get it balloted and everything, but it was still the same.
Brilliant.
Another one, remember the old whistles? That used to put on the kettles, and he used to tell you that it was
boiled,
and he used to whistle. Well, there was one time, there was the kit man, he was going down to Goodison this day, and I think the kit man had played a prank on Gazza, so Gazza's come in, and he's got the whistle off the kettle, and he's banged it onto his exhaust, but that's what tapped it on, he doesn't know, so get ready. The kit man starts the car, and he's like that, so he puts his foot on the accelerator, he goes, all you can hear is, and there's this whistle, and as he's going down the driveway out of the training ground, you've got this high-pitched whistle, and you could hear it from a mile away as he's driving to Goodison. He was just a laugh a minute.
But a good guy, yeah.
Brilliant.
You played with some characters, didn't you? Mm. We had one of them, Tommy Gravison. Yeah. I want to know if you're responsible for that mad accent.
Oh, I don't know who's responsible for that accent.
Something else, isn't it?
Tommy had a better Scouse accent than me.
Was he mad there as well?
Oh, he was crazy. Uh-huh. He was crazy. Tommy he's a larger than life character, Tommy. Well, in fact, no, he's probably not. Tommy was, if you don't know Tommy, where Tommy is now sums Tommy up. He's in Las Vegas. And that probably sums him up in a nutshell.
Uh-huh. Did the lads love him?
Oh, they loved him. Tommy would, he was an enigma. One week he would come in a Nissan Micra, and 3 weeks later he'd come in a Porsche table, and he'd go, I go, Tommy, why Micra 1 week, Porsche? He'd go, the Micra, lad. He said, it gets me in and around Liverpool and I can park anywhere with it. And I'm looking, I'm going, wow. And now he's in Vegas, uh-huh, playing the casinos and doing really well.
Some man. Obviously, a young Wayne Rooney came through the ranks while you were there. Did you know he would go on to have the career he had?
He was unbelievable. Best I've ever experienced. You know, I think Wayne started training with us when he was 16. We'd heard about him when he was 14. He was playing for the under-18s or 14. Oh. You know, and he was doing what he was doing then. And he came to us, I think, towards the end of one season, because he didn't want to move him up too quick. And he come onto the training pitch, and he was a very sheepish little bull, basically. That's the best way to describe him. And he was in awe of all us because, you know, we were like his heroes. I don't know why. You know, when he walks onto the pitch and he's got that swagger, but you know, he's obviously a confident lad. And then we're training, and then I was marking him at times in the training, and then obviously not. And then you look at him and go, well, this kid's got a bit, you know, and he was doing things that he shouldn't have been doing. His movement, his awareness, his strength, you know, he was 16, but was physically a man. You know, he was special.
Would you put one on him and try to tough
yeah.
on it?
Yeah.
And would you take it?
It just, like he was hitting a wall, you just bounce off him. Uh-huh. You know, there's obviously a few times where you catch him, but not once would he shake it. Yeah. You know, he had everything. Wayne was one of them players, and not many people can do this. He could play any position and would be very good in them positions just because his attributes. You know, he'd be the first on the training pitch every day. Bag of balls over his shoulder, and then he'd be out there and he'd be clipping balls from the halfway line onto the crossbar on the edge of the box. And then he'd always, 15 minutes before training, 20 minutes before training, he'd get the gloves on because he fancied himself as a keeper and all. And he'd be, next minute, the cat, we called him the cat. Because he'd be plucking balls out of the top corner.
Brilliant.
And like, we're looking at him going, oh, what's he doing? You know, he's going to get hit before he trains. But you know, I got on really well with him. I like become a little bit of a father figure to him. You know, I used to take him home from training afterwards and, you know, look after him that way and, you know, got on great with him and, you know, he become a friend, but special player.
Is he a shy lad? Because he comes across that way.
Yeah, he's, you know, he's probably camera shy, uh-huh. But he knows exactly what he wants. You know, if you speak to him away from the cameras and if you were a teammate, he's a very clear and focused individual. You know, no one would stop, no one would stand in his way. He knows where he's going. And if you're in the way, be prepared to get knocked out the way.
Uh-huh. You went into management yourself with mm-hmm. Hibs, your first yeah. job. What was the expectations for Hibs that first year? Obviously, Rangers and Hearts were in the league as well.
Probably stability was the one because it was, you know, it had gone through a relegation the previous season. There was a lot of turmoil and a lot of animosity around the club at the time. I think there was a lot of, towards the chairman, a lot of fans wanting a takeover, wanting to leave. We felt as if there was big bridges to build in terms of the relationship towards the fans and the club. It was very much a us and them type of feeling which we felt, and Leanne was really, well, she was fantastic, to be honest, with me and George in terms of trying to help get the fans back on board and feel as if it was their club rather than anything else. And we slowly but surely started to build. It was a total transformation. You know, I went in there and I had 9 players, you know, and we had to try and be competitive and build a promotion winning team, which I think if anyone's being honest, it was never going to happen, you know, in that first season.
See what you say there, we only had 9 players. Did that not put you off the job a wee bit? Or were you just desperate to get it?
I was ready for management. You know, I was doing the 23s at Everton and I loved it. But it was as if it just whetted my appetite even more to feel as if I was ready to make that step. You'd have 9 players, but obviously you know it's going to have to change and you have to build a squad. The good thing for me at the time was that I was able to put my stamp on that squad because it was going to be, it wasn't as if you were inheriting 26 players and you're having to try and get rid of a lot of them, you know, and that becomes difficult. So first season we did okay. Second season we obviously expected to put up more of a challenge. Hearts, you know, they romped the league in the first year. Our biggest threat was going to be Rangers in the second year. And we knew deep down it was going to be an uphill battle in terms of their budget. They'd got their act together a little bit by bringing in Mark Warburton. They'd brought in a few players, so we knew it was going to be difficult.
As you say, the second season it was you and Rangers going for the title.
Yeah.
Conte and Mourinho are now copying Warburton and Stubbs. Did that war of words, did that motivate you even more to?
Yeah, Mark seemed to take the bait a little bit with me on a few occasions, so I thought, well, if he's going to take it, I might as well carry it on a little bit. And he didn't like me referencing to the budget on occasions. I think the bit that started it was the fact early on in the season with Scott Allen, when they tried to come in for him. And I think timing is everything. And not to say that if I'm in management, I would have done anything like that in terms to buy an opposition player from the team. But I think there was more to it from that. And then when I rang Mark personally and spoke to him about it and said, listen, it ain't happening. Forget it. So,
how did he manage it?
Mark tried to say he didn't really know how the club was working and it was upstairs it was coming from, which that was Mark's version of the events. Mm-hmm. It certainly wasn't mine. Mm-hmm. And I said to him, listen, out of respect, it ain't happening, I can assure you. I've spoken to the club, and if Scott Allen leaves, I'll be leaving. That's how much I know for a fact it ain't going to happen. And they came back in, and then he came back in again, which I thought was disrespectful. I rang him the second time. There was never going to be a third time, because for me, he'd stepped over that manager respectfulness.
Mm-hmm. You achieved probably the greatest result in Hibs' history, winning the Scottish Cup against Rangers. What was your memories of that game?
Well, the players did. I was part of it, but the players, were the ones who achieved it. I knew they could achieve it. I think I'd done a few press conferences earlier in that season, and we had the opportunity of doing a treble at one point in that season, and people scoffed at it, and I could see a little smirk on some of the press guys that were in the press conferences to say, yeah, good one. We've got to the final and we should have won the League Cup against Ross County. We got to the Scottish Cup final, and then it all caught up with us in the end in terms of the league. If we would have had a bigger squad, then we would have won the league. I have no doubt about that. Mm-hmm. But we were asking the same players to keep producing and keep producing week in and week out, and we needed to give them a break, but we couldn't really. So for me, it was just a reward of all the hard work that they did. We'd lost to Falkirk in the playoffs through a poor decision, to be honest, at Easter Road, which was to make it 3-1 going on 4-1, because we were way on top at the time. And then we obviously lost to an injury time goaler at Falkirk, which we were prepared to go into extra time. And it was one of them where if you want to feel sorry for yourself, that was the time to feel sorry for yourself. Mm-hmm. But we weren't about that. We'd had a lot of mud thrown at us in terms of Hibs as a club. We had the thing as bottlers, at the same people were saying Hibs did, which for me was very hard to take, because I worked with players week in and week out, day in and day out. When you see the effort and the type of characters they are, I thought that was very disrespectful. I can see why they've said it. Press have a job to do, but I thought it was disrespectful. So to actually finish the season on a high, it was one where you look back and you go into the press room at the end of the game and you look at everyone who questioned people's character, people's bottle, and you look at them with a big cheesy grin on your face and go, what are you going to say now?
Mm-hmm. And what about the night after it? Same as the old days?
Quietish. I think the players certainly had a better night out than me. Mine was good, but we had an event on the following day, and it's fair to say that some of them hadn't been home or to bed, which they deserved it. I've got no gripe to bear about that. You know, I'm surprised some of them only went out for a couple of days.
How's that feeling different for you, winning someone as a player to a manager?
As a manager, you feel a lot more self-satisfaction because of the amount of people it means to. I think when you're winning as a player, it's an individual. You know, it's you look back and you go, there's my medal, or I won the league then. But as a manager, it involves a wider audience, you know, so it's not just about the squad of players you've got. It's about the people who work behind the scenes, your staff, your kit men, your people who work at the stadium, the commercial side, the fans, the board. So, you know, you're achieving something which has an impact on more than just an individual. Which is the most pleasing thing for me, you know, for all the hard work, what they come through, and the flak that some of them are taking, to actually come out the other side, and to achieve something which was so enormous, was more satisfaction in that, you know, players as individuals, selfish players, you know, you come across teammates, some of them very selfish, as a manager, it's not about that. You know.
Uh-huh. And looking at your back, isn't it?
Yeah, off. I'm ready. I've been out too long, mm-hmm. to be honest. I've had a few opportunities. I've probably had about 3 or 4 opportunities to get back in, but haven't been right ones. But I am itching to get back in now. You know, I'm ready. I've had a really good break. Family say too long of a break.
That's what I was gonna say.
You know, but I am ready. And, you know, but I'm very conscious that I need, you know, the next one's important. They're all important, but the next one is important to get in.
Wish you all the best, big man.
Cheers,
thanks very much for doing that.
Thank you very much. Cheers. Thank you.